Welcome back to Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampancy.net podcast. I'm Narcogen, the webmaster of Bungie Fans at Rampancy.net, and I'm here today with Blackstar of Blackstar Productions.
Hey, what's up?
As well as joined once again here by number one Bungie fan, Miguel Chavez. How are you, Miguel?
Hey there. Good to be back.
Glad to have you back with us. And having just finished our epic series of podcasts on Halo 3... just last week, only 2 years after the game came out, yay us, Bungie has a new game out, ODST, and we're going to start talking about that. It's going to be a little bit of a different format this time. We do have a film that we're going to share, like we did last time, but I still don't have the game. So hopefully that means this podcast won't be so much of me talking. It's going to be you guys talking, because all I have is your little film to watch, Blackstar. I don't have the game yet. Hopefully I'll have it in a couple of weeks.
Well, you know, hopefully the FedEx guys will be arriving in your doorstep sometime soon, and you'll be able to join the online thrilling experience that the rest of us are all thoroughly enjoying. The film is actually just a poorly played, due to the video delay.
On normal.
I wanted to demonstrate basically the interactions that any player would have, as opposed to jumping on Heroic or Legendary, which, you know, diehard or regular fans would, which is obviously increasing the difficulty so people don't get bored. Whereas this one, I was trying to make it a little bit easier, especially not so much a challenge of gameplay, but to give an ebb and flow and an element of exploration so that people could absorb the environment. So it's more of an introductory rather than a fantastic demonstration of playing skills or anything like that. In other words,
there was a lot of delay, is what you're saying.
Three to 5 seconds, because I was monitoring the video output through the setup I was using, and unfortunately, you'd move the thumbstick, you'd wait a few seconds, and then the character would move. So, you'll have to see or muddle through a couple of terrible grenade tosses and a few horribly missed headshots.
My first game of online multiplayer Halo 2 was against Mig, and I was actually playing the game through the viewfinder of a camcorder.
Because you wanted to record it, or because your TV was busted?
Because the only connection I had that was good enough for Xbox Live, it was in my office, and I didn't have a television in the office, and I didn't have a cable to hook up the Xbox to a monitor, but I could bring in my camcorder and I could plug in the composite video outs of the Xbox into the camcorder, and I was watching it through that.
Was it at least in color?
Oh yeah, it was in color, but I mean it was like a 1-inch screen.
Yeah. Well, you know I would say if the podcast fans, it seems like you've been actually getting some feedback from the last one. Or last set of podcasts.
Yeah, good feedback.
Say that they don't mind, Brian amping up the difficulty, then I would say go for it.
Okay.
Well, hopefully we'll get more people listening in.
We'll see if we can't get you some better video capture gear and get rid of the delay in the recording. But anyway, why don't we then get ready to start watch this film?
It's all queued up. I'm all set. Mig, you're all set. Narc, you want to give us a playback count?
Sure, I will. I'll give you 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play. Online interactions not rated by the ESRB. Okay.
Yeah, well, they have to give notification that you are going to be hearing a lot of annoying people swear at you. And apparently they shot this over Seattle.
Well, one thing I have down in my notes watching this film is that I think this is the first Halo game that begins with a text crawl, a kind of Star Wars-style text crawler.
It's the story so far.
Do people really not know this? I was wondering, of course they want to make every game accessible to people who maybe haven't played the others, but I mean, at this point, with the sales figures being what they are for the franchise, are there really that many people who buy ODST who haven't played at least one of the other games?
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of players that I've met that have never even touched the campaign.
Really?
And they just buy
the
game to hop on to get the achievements and multiplayer. And
also, you know, so got to think that.
Did they skip this then, or?
Yeah, they would skip this, but I guess for those other, maybe not at that extreme, but other folks who have played the game, but just as a shoot and run, I guess they could be a little confusing, and I guess this is at least one way to kind of bring some people to speed. I would have to say, even as much of a fan as I am, I still need to be reminded exactly, you know, where things are, what the situation is. I know that things have blown up and giant pieces of the story have moved along, but every now and then this is 6 years, 7 years since the first game, maybe even longer.
Oh, even longer than that.
Well, I don't know. November 2001, but if you count back to the announcement, I mean, it was summer of 99, so it's more than 10 years since the announcement. Better late than never.
And keep in mind, you know, you got to think that there will be some players, even if they may have heard about it, this is their first Halo game.
For us.
So you got to start off, at least from the perspective that, okay, we want to introduce you to this. We'll get the introduction. We start with a cool cutscene here. We actually get a chance to see the Firefly crew introducing us to ships hanging over New Mombasa, which is interesting because we haven't had a good briefing like this before. Replacements?
Many years into the war, who isn't?
The thing I notice about this is that I was wondering, are Nathan Fillion and Adam Baldwin especially, are they really just playing their characters from Firefly? I mean, Buck does seem a lot like Malcolm Reynolds.
It would be tough, I think, for them to get away from the history, but yeah, I think anything that they do will always be compared to that because there are such diehard fans of both universes. I don't think you can really escape that completely.
Seriously? If we can start the criticism early on in the game, I would say that this, like when they've in the interviews that Bungie have given about this, they've always said it was great to get teams from Firefly here, and it was like I think that kind of overrode the purpose of the story, instead of it becoming, you know. Let's get good actors that can convey the... I'm not saying that these actors aren't great. They are great, but it does turn into a Firefly reunion.
Is it bad?
A little... Well, it's not, you know...
Relax, rookie. You don't mean nothing.
It's kind of Hollywood.
One of those times.
You know? Now there's like a meta purpose to the voice acting, you know?
Maybe.
And it's kind of got... To me, it was like, you know, I'm not really interested in having to feel like I'm seeing a Firefly get together. And I also have to say, these opening animations do that over-exaggerated posing that kind of feels a little cheesy to me. But the emotion here during the actual drop, I mean, because now you can
see... Yeah, it was stunning.
Talking.
I have to say, I actually like the scene. Maybe I'm just too big a Firefly fan to really let it bother me if it turns out to be a reunion. There were a couple of other things that I noticed, though. One of which was that the original source material for this cinematically really was more Aliens than Firefly, and I couldn't help thinking back to the dropship scene in Aliens with Corporal Hicks sleeping during the drop. And that definitely reminded me of that scene here of the rookie. He's sleeping through this argument they have, and then they wake him up. And he doesn't move when the drop starts. He was actually sleeping in his pod.
Yeah, there was definitely a similarity. It actually reminded me of the original Halo 1, because I remember the first time we played it, I got a serious Aliens vibe. I don't know if you remember that. And when you walk down the hallway and you see, you know, Missing Cat answers to the name of Jonesy, it's like... Obviously, you know, Bungie are huge fans too. So this whole dropship sequence, yes, felt very much like the original in Aliens. And as you see them, as you see them plummet, all of a sudden the pod suddenly, you know, jars from the explosion, and you start seeing the load sequence. What'd you think of this, as far as the introduction of what you've seen, Narc?
I liked it. I mean, I read a lot of criticism of the scenes. I read criticism that there were a couple of things that I would point out, though, that I also thought were a little bit off. Romeo makes this remark about, you know, he didn't notice her helmet because he wasn't looking at her gear. I realize what they're trying to do with that scene, but I think that scene was written and then the scene was animated and there was not much of a connection between it. I don't know about anybody else, but in the uniform anyway, these figures don't come across to me as sexually attractive. So I'm like, well, what was he looking at? I don't know. I mean,
I'd imagine that the rationale there is that after however many decades of fighting and being in uniform, any little
it's,
bump,
it's a woman.
Is enough to get
you.
Oh
my god, I saw that curve on that breastplate.
So what? The military in 2552 is still not fully integrated? I mean, there are female soldiers in Halo 2 and Halo 3, and you don't see people making those kinds of cracks.
Right. No, you know what? I completely agree with you. I mean, this could go, we could turn this into a whole thing about my problems with it, you know, is like it got a little cheesy, and it was like, you know, and I think somebody, I don't know if it was on the HBO forums or where it was, but somebody said, listen, you know, in the military, this would never fly. You know, people are way too efficient, way too concentrated on the job at hand. And you know, and this leads into the typical, well, you know, realistic or fun. And
I've heard some other stories that might contradict that. From people in the military.
Well, but I guess it depends on the sort of what sort of extremism you want to take. Is it the it's not so much sexism, but this sort of like a need to release, you know, pent up tension.
Okay.
I want to keep
us moving here because watching on the video, because there are just so many huge changes here. We've already seen one, which is the rookie falls out of the pod and gets hurt. So we've got damage, and then we've got a health station. We're back to Halo 1 now.
Well, even before that, the whole introduction of how you orient yourself, I thought the integration of actually performing a task rather than the prior
the explosive
several games.
Bolts.
Yeah, the explosive bolts I thought was very neat. But yeah, you feel fall damage, there's gravity, and you get introduced to this whole dark, very, very dark environment.
And then also the
pistol's back and the visor, which was really an interesting way to help combat, you know, some of the darkness problems.
How's the pistol, guys? Why don't Spartans have the visor system?
Because they don't get the latest toys. You know, they're out saving the galaxy. They're a little bit further away as far as shipping goes. You should know how that feels. So getting the latest equipment is definitely not a huge thing for Spartans to
because
be able
the,
to get.
The trade-off, losing the motion sensor and gaining the visor, I think I'd take the visor every time just watching
this
being played.
I have not looked at
to
radar
be able to
in
have
years.
To have the map, to be able to set your own waypoints, to have the compass up there. And I think actually getting rid of the motion sensor actually helps. It means that some enemies can get in behind you and you can get surprised. And that never happens when you've got the motion detector.
No, I very
Brian,
much agree.
What did you think of what did you think came first, the visor mechanic and or the art being so dark? Because it almost feels like you can't help but have to play with the visor because some of the areas are just so dark. And I don't know, you know, maybe this is just me with my TVs and projector and like all that, but it was always it was interesting. Like, I sometimes felt like, well, let me play under natural conditions. And I'm not even talking about these parts where we're, you know, it's in the city at like night. I'm even talking during some of the other scenes. I wonder if allowing visor mode gave them the freedom to kind of let things be pitch dark in certain, you know, corners and such, and or if even it was something that you even noticed or cared, you know.
It's an interesting question, and the only comparison I could think of, because I honestly don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg here, whether they started out with dark environments and this was a way to combat people that may have issues with that, Or it just, after a while, it just got too monotonous and they wanted to give the player options. Or I like to think of it that is possibly a throwback to the original Halo 1, because if you remember, the sniper visor vision enhancement was apparently a last-minute add-in that was pushed by one of the Bungie people. It apparently became very, very popular. A lot of people liked it. And then in later reiterations, it was missing or they didn't include it for whatever reason. I don't know whether it was technical or aesthetic. But here it's returned, and instead of having a simple through the bore scope enhancement, you've actually got a full-blown entire screen enhancement. And I personally liked it. I loved the Sniper Edition, so the people at Bungie who made that, thank you so much. It really made Halo 1 hit home for me. But for here,
I think it looks great. It looks like a huge improvement over the flashlight mechanic.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm so sick of flashlight mechanics. I hate the whole Doom 3 tunnel vision attempt that they make, where this is definitely an improvement, and it really enhances the gameplay, which is a major importance as far as this, because there are so many levels, like Mig mentioned, that are incredibly dark. Even, I mean, I set the
Who's Kinsler?
To max. Well, Kinsler is a character we'll come into later. Narc was just noticing some
The graffiti on the
wall. The graffiti on the wall. But as far as the visuals and everything go, I don't know which came first, but it definitely helps. And if it wasn't there, I do think that this would be lacking. If it didn't have it and everyone was playing it through the incredibly dark environments, it would hurt the gameplay instead of help it. So it is very a necessary mechanic. I, in fact, thought of one of the challenges that Bungie might add would be to try and play through this without turning visor mode on once. And I can't imagine anyone actually doing it. So it is very necessary. Another element here, which is the new overhead map, as we're seeing here.
Yeah, the map. We're watching the... you've accessed the first superintendent terminal, and you've got access to its, I guess, kind of like a pseudo 3D map. Map in a Halo game.
Since really, Marathon.
Marathon had it. I mean, Myth also had kind of a different implementation, but this is a lot like the map that's in Marathon.
Oh, it brought flashbacks. I can remember the online stuff that we used to do playing Marathon, and this just absolutely jumped out at me and said, wow, they really nailed it, because the functionality of how it works is incredibly intuitive. It is very helpful. The only problems that I had with it at all were the several elements where the overhangs or buildings kind of encroached over where you were looking at, but that's basically because of the 3D element. You can't really get around that. But this was the ultimate GPS, and I so look forward to them keeping this in any future titles or any future games that they do, because it is so helpful.
Are we assuming that that Reach, whatever kind of game that turns out to be, that it's going to have these improvements, that it's going to have the map and it's going to have the visor mode, and that it's going to have, assuming that it also features ODSTs and not Spartans, that it'll also have fall damage and stamina instead of shields? I mean, is that what we're thinking they're going to go?
I certainly hope so. Mig, what do you think, or what are your hopes?
Well, I have to say, Narc, I'm not really sure where I stand with the with where Reach is, because as much as I like to think that they'll pull some of the elements from ODST into Reach, I also get the feeling, just from the last 2 years or so of the churning and so on that was going on with personnel, that it seems like Reach is such a whole new launching pad, I think, for them. So I'd imagine that we might actually see quite a few new elements. There might not be very much at all that's coming from ODST.
So you think Reach is a whole new engine and not just a bigger project like this?
Yes, it could be a new engine. I mean, where I'm coming from with this crazy idea is, and I think I might have hinted at this either in forum posts or on previous podcasts, that Jason Jones, one of the Bungie founders, he doesn't really appear in the credits except as a general thanks in the last couple of games. So
really?
Where has he been? What's he been doing? And
he's taking his feet up on the desk. He's watching the money roll in.
Something that drew his interest back in. And my feeling is that he likes to, when he does work on something, that what gets his interest is to do something with a fresh take, with a fresh spin. And so maybe imagine that here he is after quite a few years of having seen the genesis of Halo, and then the making of the sequels. Maybe he would have wanted to try something fresh, try something new. And so, yes, maybe Reach is a completely new take. I mean, we don't even know. There's not even a guarantee that it's an FPS. And I guess we'll be finding out soon just what exactly Reach is. But I guess I'm just thinking that this could be something completely new and different, and maybe not anything at all that what we see now in ODST. Is that a foolish assumption on my part? Possibly. But it's also hopeful on my end to see something new, something with something a little daring. Otherwise, what has Jason Jones been doing the last couple of years?
Just want to point out, we went by another piece of graffiti there that said, "You loot, I shoot," and that's another thing that brings up some questions in my mind about the timeline here, right? I mean, this game starts just as Regret's carrier has left. Now, in Halo 2, we see his carrier arrive. Now, I'm not really sure how much time, but I always got the sense playing the game that it was a few days, maybe even just hours, that this attack lasted. And that I always figured that, you know, between Halo 2 and Halo 3, there might be a long time. There might be a relatively long occupation. You know, they talk about some of these slip space journeys taking days or weeks sometimes, you know, in time back home. But is it really gotten to the point where, you know, the city has so broken down that there are roving gangs of looters? I mean, this attack was just a little while ago. I just, that's one of the few things that makes me wonder about the timeline.
Right, but if you remember, Narc, and I always thought it was kind of clever on their part, but in the Halo 3 announcement trailer, we got to see through all the smoke and the bits and pieces of the space elevator, the Master Chief emerge from the dust and all that. And there you see on the side there the little shaking, like the yield sign for grunts.
Yeah, the grunt warning sign.
Grunts crossing.
I always thought that was kind of a joke, though.
Right, yeah, no, I am making kind of a joke there. But you mentioned the looters, and I thought it was kind of clear in the, you know, if you've read the novels and so on and kind of follow the history of not just the alien turmoil, but also what was happening in the cities themselves on Earth. I don't think it's that far-fetched to think that there was already quite a bit of civil strife happening in certain parts of the world, and maybe with the Covenant invasion, that just kind of exacerbated things. So I kind of didn't. I thought maybe there was a little bit of overlap going on in there. Maybe not completely spelled out, and maybe a wrong assumption on my part again. But that's what I kind of thought when I saw that those markings.
Oh, sure. Well, sure it was, but it wasn't on Earth. Remember, the Halo 2 opening cinematic is the first attack, you know, on Earth. And then, you know, we repel the borders on the station, and then we go down onto the Earth, and there's two levels, and at the end of that two levels, Regret's carrier leaves. But you're right, a lot of activity seems to go on. In fact, now we're inside some of the interiors here, and we can see a lot of Covenant graffiti. Some of these symbols in groups of three, similar to what we saw back in Halo 1 in the areas where the Flood was contained. Now we're seeing... Yeah, yeah. And they're everywhere, lots of them, and they're meticulous. They look like they were created mechanically. They don't even look like, you know, somebody wrote this on the wall with their hand.
All right. Yes. The these markings, it's really something, I have to tell you, Narc. I know you haven't gotten it yet, but it's really fascinating to see what they did with those markings. They of course they harken back to the stuff we saw back in the earlier Halo games. I think folks have been trying to crack the code and make sense of what the Yes, there's have been attempts at deciphering it. I'm not sure where that stands now, though. But more importantly, it hints at a sort of a meta story, or a story that's kind of coming alongside the main story, you know. And I thought it was actually quite clever of them to put it in. It does add something to the game that we thought we were not going to see in the game. So I have to give them a thumbs up for doing that. I thought it was nice. As a matter of fact, I think Blackstar is doing a good job here of if he could move the camera around a little bit, you could have seen some of the things I was kind of talking about. But
I didn't want to show him too much. I wanted him to find it on his own.
them being there, like it shows that obviously there's things that are going on the surface of their machinations going on. And why is that happening? You know,
they were hanging out.
Like a brand new invasion. It was just happening now. But obviously there are things that have been going on coming up to this point.
But that makes sense, because even before the ODSTs know that that Regret's carrier is leaving, Dare is obviously taking them somewhere else, and Buck knows it, and that's why he knows they're going to the surface, and that's why Romeo needs the sniper. Oh, yes, and it's a flashback to 20 minutes ago.
You gonna tell us her name, Gunny?
Ms. Naval Intelligence. Our new boss. So check your mouths, find your chairs, and get set for a combat drop.
Well, no, actually, and one thing I wanted to mention before we got off on a giant tangent was that the question that you had about the passage of time in the story in Kinsler is that the way that the Bungie decided to introduce the particular characters in the backstory, because the first character you meet is actually 6 hours delayed as opposed to where major actions in the game are. You've been asleep in the pod for all this time. And the way that they helped you integrate as far as what happened while you've been busy or while you've been out were the audio files and the phone that was ringing that you saw before, and you get a chance to interact with the new AI, the replacement for Cortana, which is the superintendent. And he signals all these different phones and credit card machines and things around the city for you to get audio files that tell a backstory, and the whole element of what happened and who people are is another element to playing the game.
I'm looking forward to that too, but I also think it does seem to require a passage of more time. I mean, BioShock has that, but BioShock's auto directories happen over a course of months as you're finding out about the story of the collapse of the city. And the same thing with Doom, right? You show up in Doom 3, and the audio journals are telling you about the things that have gone wrong over this project. But the Covenant have only been on the Earth. I mean, even if you stretch the timeline, it's a few days. It's not so much the Kinsler was here graffiti I have the problem with. It's the you loot, I shoot stuff, where people have already established themselves as territories and are protecting property, and there are roving gangs of looters, and it seems like that's really quick for society to collapse so far.
Well, I think in the audio files you do get more of an explanation for it, and as the story progresses you do get an idea for it. But yeah, unless you have a specific timeline as far as what happens when, then yeah, that might give you the impression.
There's another bit coming up that I'm going to take exception to, but before we get there, I'm on my way. This scene's out, and again, I suppose we shouldn't really go into a feminist rant here, but we've again got Bungie putting a damsel in distress. I do appreciate that they took the time to make it not her fault. I assume that whatever fault that Dare's pod has, it has nothing to do with her being a woman, and that even if it had been one of the men, if the pod had broken in that way, they would not have been able to force their own way out. But it is strange, right? There are, you know, several members in this crew, but the one whose pod doesn't work and it gets strapped is the woman.
Well, Captain Keyes had to be rescued twice, and he was a man, so I don't see how that even enters
Buck's
into
ex,
it.
And Buck's ex-girlfriend. We talked about in the last episode how you play three games and you realize that Halo was a love story between the Chief and Cortana, but they come right up front with this one, aren't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they wanted to keep it obvious.
Oh, boy, yeah.
You don't like it?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of this of what they attempted to do here. It's probably my biggest gripe with the game is that up until this point, if you follow the novels, if you follow the games, if you look at the marketing and the posters and all that ancillary stuff for Halo, the idea is that these Marines, the ODST, the Spartans, they're the best of the best. They're committed to get the job done. Full steam ahead. There's never any sort of schmaltzy, I love you, that I miss you, where did we go wrong, why aren't you with me? And yet here we kind of plopped right down into something where Dare and Buck have feelings for each other, and it almost feels like something out of it's almost too soap opera-ish, it was one thing to kind of have the kind of soap opera that we were used to, where it was more about a grander scheme kind of stuff, the earth is in peril and all that, but now this is so trivial, it feels like, to me. I mean, maybe the excuse is that Buck is a grizzled veteran, he has seen so many things, and so he can be excused for feeling hopeless about what's been going on, and that this is his one ray of sunshine, I guess, there. But at the same time, it still bothered me. I just didn't think that that the Marines would do, or rather the ODST would show such a soft side, for him to insist on trying to get there, it just seemed a little bit too much over the top.
A lot of those rescues don't really make sense either because of how big the story is, right? They set up in the first Halo game how big the stakes are, right? All life in the galaxy, and yet they're still stopping to save individual people first, and then they get on with the business of, making sure the galaxy isn't destroyed. So I think they consistently have that kind of prioritization problem. Just to comment on a couple of things we've watched here, they've got a new, leading cast, right? Because there's no Chief, there's no Cortana, there's at least, not as far as I've seen so far, no Johnson. We've got the Firefly cast again. But the supporting cast, there are some of the same actors. We've just heard the voice of, what was it, Private Chips Double, the Australian guy. And isn't he supposed to be on Delta Halo? And then I think in a couple of minutes we're going to hear Michelle Rodriguez, and she's supposed to be on Delta Halo 2 at this point.
Yeah, they recycled several of the voice characters that obviously were popular.
Yeah, hearing them again, I thought that was pretty interesting. I figured that's, a little something that Marty kind of throws back. The fans really like hearing these voices that they did so, they've done such a great job with them over previous games. So why not try to bring some of them back? I thought that was nice. But, at the same time, I tried to excuse it in saying... and thinking that, maybe there's something going on here with the Marines, the ODST as well, that maybe some of these are the best of the best clones, of these kind of physical specimens. And so that's why you get some of that. I know that doesn't really explain accents and all that, but still I thought that was kind of... a cute way of looking at it, Right, Flash clones, right?
Well, if you think of Flash cloning from the original Halo 1, I mean, John was replaced with a Flash clone, so obviously they have the technology to do some level of it. Hey, guess what?
The Flash clones all die.
So do the Marines. So, yeah. I don't think them surviving too long is a worry. Yeah. I think they simply, Marty decided to pick the popular voice characters for certain people that you run into because they're familiar, people know them, people like them, and dosh gone it, they like them. So yeah, it's just an element of the story that they decided to bring into that people have enjoyed before and will again. And what we're looking at actually now is kind of an interesting example.
Narc, this is the, I think, what we're seeing here is that section that I kind of alluded to previously about finding things that, or not things, maybe creatures that we did not think that we were going to find before. And
I guess I missed that.
Oh, the what the
elites? The elites were oh, yeah. something that you saw them yeah, being but, dead. Okay,
that's the other bit I was going to remark on because I think he doesn't mention it there, but the Buck actually mentions it and Dare references it in dialogue.
Yes,
in a later scene, and that was again brought up the timeline to me. And I have a big problem justifying that with the timeline of Halo 2. There isn't open fighting between those two factions until much later in Halo 2, and there's every reason to believe that the journey to Delta Halo took days or weeks. So I suppose they could retcon it and say that, well, this transition was always planned, and so Truth left orders for it to be done and to get rid of all the elites after Regret left or something. But it doesn't sit quite right. I think it's more of a gameplay concern. I think they know that people like to fight elites, that not everybody is a big fan of brutes. They thought that this was an opportunity for there to be more fighting with elites. But I think in the gameplay model, in the squads that they construct, brutes have taken over the role that elites had to play in terms of how they behave and the relationship between them and the other units with the hunters and the jackals and the grunts. A squad that had brutes and elites in it would be redundant. I think like that they in fact fixed the brute AI, which was kind of uninteresting in Halo 2, simply by making them behave a lot more like elites. And if they were in the same group in the same encounters, that would just become too apparent. So I think they threw this in here about the brutes killing off the elites so early, just to try and explain why they're not in the game.
Isn't it? Don't you think it's interesting that it seems to be a surprise to Dare? I mean, like, what is the sequence here? Is did Dare were they made privy to this as it happened, or did they stumble upon it? I really wasn't clear there.
No, she said. No, he says. Buck asks if something funny is going on, and Dare says it's classified, which. Suggests that she knows. So that suggests not only is there fighting between those two groups on Earth before there is, you know, before the Arbiter is betrayed, before the counselors are killed, but not only has it happened, but that Naval Intelligence is aware of it, which is really interesting. Also, since you guys have played on other difficulties, some of the tips that they give you, is that because of the difficulty level? Do you not get those? Because he asks for help with jackals and problem. Dare gives him this hint about using the plasma pistol overcharge. And I think later Buck also makes a crack about shooting hunters in the back, which of course, you know, fans know way back to the original game, but a new player, new to the franchise, wouldn't know about.
Exactly. I think what they were trying to do is make sure that the introduction was very smooth and enjoyable for those brand new players. And again, like Mig mentioned before, there are people that have never played any of the campaign at all.
If you play on Legendary, did they give you those tips, or is it just because you're on normal?
No. The tips.
I don't think I saw those tips very much, and you know, now that I'm seeing them now, I'm just so I'm glad I didn't see them too often, because, geez, if I had to listen to them prattle, you know, listen to her prattle on about what to do. I mean, just, it was too much information overload. You know, I think I'm glad I kind of knew what to do already.
Yeah, because the difficulties are definitely interesting enough to keep you preoccupied. I personally don't remember them. I didn't play through Heroic. I played through Normal, and I played through Legendary. And from what I can recall, I don't remember them there. I do believe that the Buck dialogue sections are there, but I don't think they actually mention specifically about certain tactics or behavior. As far as the plasma pistol goes, though, this is actually one of the games that Halo's made where the plasma pistol is very much necessary. You're not a Spartan, and you don't have the regular amount of weaponry that you can use to take out certain characters. The plasma pistol for taking out certain ones are absolutely vital. They force you to combo people, which, you know, some people may like or not like. Personally, I'm not a fan of the plasma pistol. I miss the Halo 1 plasma pistol with its, you know, its particular rate of fire, which it unfortunately is not in this. But as far as taking out shields and taking out characters, you could be sitting around shooting people for absolutely forever with certain weapons and having absolutely nothing effective. And the plasma pistol, you can take him down in 3 shots. So, yeah, it is very much a necessary weapon, and they wanted to make sure that people knew it.
How do we feel about the character you're playing speaking while you're playing? Halo didn't have that because the chief was silent. Half-Life doesn't have that because Gordon Freeman never says a word at all. Gears of War did have it. You've got editorial comments, you know, from Marcus Fenix as he plays, and now you're getting a little bit of that, not from the rookie, but you're getting it from the other ODSTs. How do you guys feel about that? Does that feel like Halo to you guys?
Ugh, Gears of War. Oy vey. We really want to mention this and bring up that game.
It never really was
no?
a bother to me. Miguel obviously feels differently. The only problem I ran into it is when your behavior or your character doing things is different than what Bungie expects. They can't write dialogue segments that are apropos to every particular circumstance you may be in. And if you're looking or doing something that they aren't expecting you to do, the comment is misplaced. So as far as it actually being an element of the gameplay, it is a little bit more immersive, and it is a reminder that, yes, you are a different character. But if I'm looking at a wall or if I'm looking at a particular area or going someplace that they don't think I'm going to, when they mention it's like, oh, look out for that brute. Oh, I've got to shoot that hunter in the back. It's like, I'm not looking at a hunter. I'm in a building 3 feet, in the other direction.
I think it's a technique that can work, but you have to be sparing with it. And I think the temptation when you implement something like that is that, well, we've written the code to do this feature, and now we have to make sure we use this feature, because if it only happens a few times, it was a waste to spend the man hours to code it. I think it works, pretty well actually in Gears, because it doesn't happen that often, and it's usually on very specific things. Like, for instance, Marcus Fenix always makes a crack when you miss a grenade throw. And therefore, it's always appropriate when he makes it.
Right, and, but you see, when you say it's always appropriate when he makes it, that kind of gets away. I mean, that's always been my complaint about Gears, is that it's linear. You know, it's you're kind of it's almost it's like a rail shooter. So while I like that the engine, has evolved to the point where it can do that, it's also, to me, it takes away from the my imagination filling in on what the chief would say during certain scenarios where maybe if I'm in a stealthy mood or if I'm more of a kick-ass kind of mood, if instead I'm always having to hear Steve Downes do his voice and it's always a wisecrack, or it's always, maybe it's just 3 or 4 variations of something. I don't know. I think it's I guess it depends on how intricately entwined it is with it understanding its the reality at that moment. Things which are happening. The grunts that are running away, the elites which are charging, and so on, for it to really kind of make sense. But I'm not sold on it being worth the effort.
If there was one for an enemy being killed as a result of an action, or an enemy not being killed, like I said, you're right. I mean, Gears is overall is more linear. Before we get to that, though, I want to mention here, we've got this superintendent I think it's clever the way they've done that, right? It seems like he doesn't have a full speech synthesis AI thing going like Cortana.
And that's something
he speaks to you through the signs and through what sounds like pre-recorded things that are designed to be in use by a civilian system. Like here, we're looking for Dare's pod, and he's telling you about you can claim your lost items from Lost and Found on the lower level. That's him telling you where the pod is.
Yeah. But
that's the only way that's the only vocabulary he has to use.
In the story's elements.
Is it really?
I think he was making a crack. He's talking about the movie, not the cartoon. No, in the story elements where you get a chance to hear the audio files, there's an explanation of the character, because this AI was originally designed to be running the city. Therefore, the responses and the interactions that he make are all based on that. So he talks about traffic. He talks about things in the elements that he would control. And yeah, it's interesting, because that way it's not a Cortana character. It's not someone that has a direct interaction, who will talk about anything, who has all these different concepts and stuff. That I thought was interesting.
Engineer,
yeah, this is the
first official appearance, and looking quite different from the model that people hacked to show in the earlier games, which was kind of all soft and squiggly. This guy's got
armor plating,
armor or something he's using to hold equipment or supplies, and what they carry.
Actually, Narc, okay. I think again, I have to be delicate here because I don't want to spoil it for you, but I think you'll see as the game progresses that the engineer, I think Bungie did actually a really good job of fleshing out an engineer's role in this covenant society of multiple cultures. And whereas at first, you know, my initial impression was of sort of a type of Ewok type of character, armored, cute little creature, although I guess that could be a stretch for some people, but... later on, you see that there's a little bit more going on here, I just thought it was interesting how Bungie took what was originally kind of like a one-note type of character and gave it a little bit more depth, and maybe we can cover that later as we continue.
That is a distinct possibility, and yeah, we'll definitely be able to elaborate it on a future podcast on the subject. But yeah, as far as this, the introduction of it, I thought it was kind of interesting because you actually had to. I remember the first time I played it, I wasn't sure exactly what was going on, and playing it again and playing through the whole game, it's like, okay, all right, now I get it. I understand what they were trying to do here. But yeah, as far as the original story though, they may have either gone off a little differently than prior ones. But, you go ahead, Nart.
Yeah, there's one more other thing I wanted to bring up before the film is just ending now. Before that final cutscene, there is some more dialogue between Buck and Dare, where again, he's telling her to hold on, he's going to be there, and she's saying that the Covenant have spotted her. And of course, when he gets there, the pod is empty, and it's only Romeo there who shoots the engineer to save him. I wanted to use that scene to explore the idea of the ticking clock a little bit. The idea that, you know, in a movie, you can do a ticking clock quite well and quite literally. You know, you can literally put a countdown on the screen if you want and say that, okay, this is a bomb that's going to go off in 5 minutes. And in 5 minutes, you can set that bomb off and the dramatic consequences then take effect. But in a game like this, it's often, I think, difficult where developers... they want to create time pressure. They want to create a sense of urgency on the part of the player that they need to press forward. They want to use this pressure to create drama. So they put that other character in peril. But, of course, you could probably... I haven't played the level myself, but I'm betting you could probably hang around that place all day and it wouldn't change events at all. You know, you could sit there for hours. There's no... because real ticking clocks are kind of annoying, like the way the final scene in Halo 1 is sometimes annoying to play all the way through and then be like, oh, I missed it by 5 seconds and the ship blows up and I have to start the whole thing over again. Did that scene work? I mean, I find a lot of times when they try and press you forward, I just get annoyed and you start talking back to the screen. And in other places it works. Did that work for you? Did you feel an urge to to push through that final encounter and get to the pod because of the dialogue, or did it not work for you?
I have to say the first time I played it, it did in fact work, because I wasn't sure whether I was dealing with a clock dynamic. I wasn't sure whether there was something I was either going to miss or whether Bungie would have decided, okay, if you do get to there by a certain point, we're going to go on this way. If you don't get there by a certain point, we're going to go this way. I wasn't sure if you were at that fork in the road.
I'd like to see them do that.
I would love to see them do that. In fact, I was hoping that in Halo 2 they were going to introduce something like that, especially with the Arbiter character, where your behavior and your actions were going to lead you down one or two set different paths. You'd still arrive at the same place. You'd be at the same level, maybe not at the same time. But at least with this one, the first time with Dare saying that she's in trouble, yeah, and of course they time it right at a point where you're dealing with hunters. So now you've got two things to deal with. One, you're a very weak, squishy human dealing with hunters now, which are definitely stronger and not as easy to take down as Halo 1. And there's a woman screaming saying, "Help me!" So yeah, it for the first time I played it, I was like, oh geez, how am I going to get over there fast enough dealing with everything I'm dealing with? Afterwards,
how about you, Mig? Did they manage to trick you into that, or you too cagey for that? Characters in Halo games sure seem to fail an awful lot. I mean, if you just look at the number of level objectives that you're given you about go here, do that, catch this guy, rescue this person. A lot of times, I mean, okay, you eventually get there, but a lot of times on a point-by-point basis, you're failing. You know, you're supposed to, you're right, you don't get a chance to, you rescue Johnson at the end, but the level objective there was written as if it was possible to get to him before he's captured, which, of course, is not possible.
Well, I think if they had too much information, it would have ruined it. I think if they had put it to the point where you could actually have done it, it wouldn't have had the same kind of impact, because obviously they want to take you on this particular storyline and give your characters a certain amount of feelings and interactions. And without that, or if they did it differently, or if you had a chance to manipulate it by your actions, they may go down someplace that either they didn't want you to go or didn't expect or wouldn't have been as fun. So yeah, so unfortunately them writing it that way, they do seem to use that element a lot, and like Miguel said, yeah, you know, the boy who cried wolf, I do feel that they tended to do it too much, and they needed to try something else or do something differently to create that same or a better level of or a different level of tension in certain moments.
Can you imagine the complainers if how much more ramped up their complaints would have been if there was even a hint that you could play like ODST and finish it within 45 minutes because you happen to take all the right, you know, forks in the road and were able to catch up to it there. And you know what I mean? I mean, I'm kind of making a joke about it, but you know,
I think the trick would be to try and make it so that it affects not the outcome events, but how they play out. Like, I mean, to some extent in Halo 3 and in Halo 2, it does. Because, for instance, if you prioritize saving your Marines, then you can have them with you longer, and further exchanges and encounters play out differently when you have help than with you by yourself. It doesn't affect the big picture. So the question would be, well, how could they write it? Again, it's a catch-22. Nobody wants to make content that people aren't going to see, and nobody wants a game that you can finish in 45 minutes if you make all the right decisions. But people, I think, do want to feel that their actions on the matter on a big scale, not just the small scale of how many shots did it take me to kill these guys and get to this point where everyone's game becomes the same. There's not a lot of games that even attempt it. The last one I can think of that did that, that's really not strictly an RPG, was Advent Rising. I don't know if either of you guys have played that. But there's actually, I mean, it's a third-person shooter. It's not an RPG. But there are some choices. Very early on in the game, there's a scene where you have to choose to rescue one character or the other. Basically, I think it's like your ex-girlfriend and your brother. And you save one of them, and the one who saves accompanies you through the rest of the game to the end. The other one is gone. And then what it turns out is that the one that you didn't save actually was rescued by your enemies and ends up being a boss at the end of the game. So it's kind of a binary choice, but it is still some impact on the on the grander stage than just who you shoot and when.
Well, as far as impact actually goes, and you mentioned the time element. Miguel mentioned the time element. I wanted to touch on this somewhat because one of the big controversies that I've heard of late are a lot of people that have had criticisms, or as Miguel says, the whiners, mentioned the length of the game and as far as how the story plays out and how long it took people to go through it. I personally, and I just wanted to mention it, I personally did not have a problem with that. I found that my particular gameplay style, and I think that's really what comes into it, was far more immersive and slow tempoed, and to the point where I was checking every corner, at least the first time I was playing through it, because I was very much trying to get immersed in this world, and I never felt that the game was too short, and yet for some reason a lot of people, like Miguel mentioned, you know, can run through this really, really quick, and the only people that would be interested in something like that are those who do speed runs. But did you feel at any time, Miguel, that this game was too short? Did you ever feel that it was actually to the point where, you know, you felt like you were going through the motions and each section that you were going through seems, you know, too fast, or you got there too soon, or you wanted it to be longer? Because I have to say, personally, I didn't have a problem with the time length at all. I thought it was very well tempoed, bouncing back and forth between playing the different characters.
Right, and I didn't really have a problem with it either, and I think it's a shame that, I mean, from what I can tell, you know, reading between the lines and supposition and so on, it was always Bungie's idea to make this like an add-on. It wasn't supposed to have been this $60 game, and maybe that's why they felt, you know, their arm was bent. $50 game. So maybe that's part of why folks feel justified in having to complain about it. But yeah, when I was playing it, it didn't seem to really bother me. But I will have to say, and this is always, you know, people who converse with me either online or in real life, know this about me. Like, I'll play a game and my feelings about it will be one thing before, during, and then after. So, like, afterwards, once I've played through the game more than, two, three times, I start to think back, you know, well, what exactly were we really doing here in this game? And I think some of the criticism about it really being just the ODST kind of just catching up with their player, you know, with the other players, really kind of is the summary of the whole thing. And it kind of makes me think, you know, wow, you know, I really just spent a game kind of just following other people's tracks. It's, you know, like what's being implied as to the reason, the motivation, like all this thing about it being a film noir and look at the mystery of ODST. Like, there's no real mystery here.
These are just grunts regrouping. I think you mentioned that in a thread on the HBO forum, and I was wondering about the same thing. I was reminded of a scene from Save It, Private Ryan, where basically what all these guys who paratrooped into France got all separated, and all they did basically, you know, they sort of tried to rejoin their own units, but basically what happens is they all joined up at some point. Some officer would come through, create a unit, and say, okay, now we're going to go off to fight. You wonder, well, what is it that's going on here that these specific soldiers need to regroup with each other instead of just saying, well, I'm going to get out of here, or I'm going to go join up at the next post, or I'm going to leave the city and find somebody who can give me an order to shoot at something. I mean,
but I have to say, like, if we're going to use Saving Private Ryan, it is that, but then.
Yeah, that's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
but the filler that to me is that you then get to see the realities of war. You get to see what it was like to be a Jew fighting against the Germans. You know, the different personalities And there are really different personalities. There are different, there's much more friction. There's much more interplay between here. To me, everything was kind of like a caricature. It was Romeo was kind of boring. You know, I could kind of tell what he was going to say even before he said it.
He's Dutch, kind of stereotypical.
And Dutch, after the first couple of sentences, you know, okay, this is going to be a guy who's pining after Dare, and you can see that he wears his emotions on his sleeve.
You mean Buck, right?
Oh, Buck. I'm sorry,
not
Buck.
Dutch. Yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. And
Dutch is Jane.
I mean, yeah, Dutch is Jane. Exactly right. So it was. It kind of made. I felt like what they were shooting for when they were promoting it is not exactly what we got when we actually played it, and maybe that's very typical. You know, when you have to market something now. You know, like I said, I think they were going for like an add-on. So, but then once it was like, well, this is a full game, we got to really sell it now. And the whole thing about it being film noir and all that, I could kind of see it, but then I'm also saying, listen, you know, especially the for me, like a movie buff, when you'd mention film noir, I'm really going to be expecting film noir. And the ODST, the player, you do not fit the idea of a film noir character. You know,
I think they didn't anticipate they'd be talking to film students when they did that. I think they mean like,
yeah,
it's going to have the accoutrements of film noir. And what we mean in that is a lot of high contrast black and white areas, which I suppose Gears of War also does better. My wife looks at Gears of War and says, "It's my God, it's a waste. There's no color. It's like you're playing on this big screen and it's color, and they don't put any color in the game."
Right.
Well, you know, they had to fill it with dystopian brown, but yeah, no. As far as the whole concept of using noir, I think they toss that phrase around like a frisbee a little too often, and I think that simply they were trying to give an impression of the darkness, the stark contrast, and the moodiness of the city that they were trying to create, the same way that, you know, Marty's music was trying to accentuate it and bring out that feel. And I think somebody just mentioned noir, and it just kind of took on a life of its own. The same way that people get hung up on the whole idea of this being an expansion pack. Personally, I didn't follow it that much thinking that it was an expansion pack. And I'm curious as to whether or not they would have even had a problem if it was sold as an expansion pack, where they never wavered from that, and they said, okay, the reason we're going to charge you $60 for this thing is because, well, you're getting $30 for the Halo ODST part, but you were also going to charge you $30 for the extra multiplayer online disc, which is basically Halo 3 multiplayer, everything, and the new maps.
I am all for expansion packs.
Yeah.
I think the problem with a company that includes kind of the full pipeline of production, right, all the way from writers through artists and designers and programmers, is that everybody needs to be doing something. And I don't really feel that I really want or need to wait 3 years between games, especially when it's supposed to be an episodic story, right? You're waiting 3 years to find out what happens next. They've already
Absolutely.
Started doing films where they film two or three at a time, and they release them, with a year interval or 6 months interval even.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because why with Xbox Live would they not want to make an episodic game system? Why hasn't somebody taken on the challenge and says, you know what, we're going to come out with something every 6 months or every year and say this is going to be a progressive element to a whole larger game?
You know, actually, there was a studio, I don't remember the name of it, I will go look it up, but there was a studio that just came out with a report, a little blog post, where they came to the same conclusion that Bungie did about 10 years ago, and it was, look at this, the frame rate has no correlation with the ratings of a game, either the overall ratings, the graphics ratings, or the sales figures. 60 frames a second versus 30. But they did see a correlation between sales, overall score, and graphics score. So I think people have much decided that basically, if you want to have a predictor of good sales, it's how good the reviewers think the graphics are. So that means
the eye candy.
Yeah, the eye candy. So you've constantly got to be pushing the engines, which means if you get two games out on an engine, you're lucky. I mean, look at what we've had in for Halo 3. That's basically three different engines over 10 years and two platforms.
Well, then it comes the question, like, okay, if we're going to be picking an engine, say we pick the Halo 3 engine, or dare I say the Halo 4 engine, or whatever's coming afterwards. If they pick that, if in their design schedule they can say, okay, this is what we're going to be using, and if we can get 3 or 4 years out of this, and we can come up with a chapter segment of, say, like, I don't know, 5, 6 levels every year, you know, have a Christmas December title.
If they could give me half the game that ODST is every six months for $30, heck, I would subscribe to that. I mean, people are already pre-ordering and pre-paying. I would just say, okay, if you're going to do 2 3-to-4-hour Halo games a year, and we'll just deliver it to your Xbox as soon as it's ready, like Steam does, right? You're going to preload parts of it so that launch day you get it. I would absolutely do that. There's no question about it.
But would you accept that if there's still the same level of retconning going on with the canon? I mean, you would. If I was to make that kind of investment, I would hope that they get all their ducks in a row and everything. I mean, just like how you're mentioning this thing about the timeline. If we're going to be that, if they're catering to that level of fandom, they have to. On the flip side, you know, they have to stay completely true to the storyline and honor it by, you know, treating things as canon. And it's interesting how, you know, story elements get shoved aside for making things interesting and moving things along. And it's too bad, but I know what you mean. I mean, I would definitely, I mean, think of it this way, the Halo novels, when they first come out in hardcover, what are they, like maybe $12, $15?
So exactly.
Certainly, I wait for paperbacks.
Certainly every 6 months to pay $30 for an expansion, I could certainly justify that.
I just couldn't understand why people were complaining about the price of the game, saying, oh, it's $60, oh, we're not getting that much. It's like, look, you're getting ODST, which is, you know, maybe for some people it was a short game, all right. But you're still getting the Halo 3 multiplayer. You're getting all the new maps. And nobody's mentioned it very much, but you're also getting the Reach Beta coming out. So the way I look at it is you're getting three games for the price of one. What's the problem? Mm-hmm. You know, what else would have satisfied you people? Would it, you know, four extra levels and the free soundtrack or something? I mean, what more do
it's
you want?
It's the difference for people who view the game as a multimedia experience, of which gaming and Challenger are part of it, as opposed to a traditional arcade type philosophy of gaming, which is that it's the game's job to try and beat you back, to stop you from advancing, to make things as hard as possible for you so that when you achieve, you know you have accomplished something and that you have demonstrated skill. So what those people want is that they're going to try to get through the game as fast as possible. And when they fail to do so, when the game makes them take a long time, the game has proved that it is good. I don't understand but I think there are people who
I don't agree with it either.
But wouldn't Bungie just turn around and say, "But listen, we just gave you the skulls."
Yeah, exactly. You gave the multiplier. You know what I mean? Like you can make it as hard as you want.
Yeah, you can turn on the skulls and make it as challenging as you want. Like, and it's funny, Narc, how you first were talking about, you know, catering to the story and trying to make things not so repetitive. And yet, like, ironically, the flip side of this game, what has captured and will probably continue to make the game live on is Firefight, which is nothing if not the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over again. And it's interesting to see the two different sides of Bungie, the philosophies of the 30 seconds of fun versus the story, how they're both kind of are distinctly highlighted here in this game. I found that very interesting. And I have to say, Firefight, it really is one of the best parts of the whole Halo series.
I think we're definitely going to have to take a good amount of time and talk about Firefight. I would like to try and wrap up this episode, though, and talk about one more thing. I want to go back just to the beginning of that film, at the end of the text crawler, where it says that that this mission that these ODSTs are on might be the most important mission of the war, which I also have to kind of question. Seems to me that if any Halo ring had gone off in Halo 1 or 2, that probably would have meant whatever these guys are doing is not that important. I assume that what they're talking about is the artifact from the I Love Bees story. I suppose I don't want you to spoil it for me or anybody else who maybe hasn't played it through yet, but knowing the end of the story, do they manage to fulfill that? Would you say it's true? We talk about these guys are just catching up with each other and trying to regroup. Are they accomplishing a mission that is the most important of a 40-year long war?
No.
Well, that's a tough one because if you think about it,
good answer.
If you think about it though, there are many times that it may not be readily apparent in a particular conflict that what anyone or what any singular particular mission has that kind of an impact, where it was either the turning point or a focal point or a major pivotal moment within, a certain time frame. So from their perspective, yeah, it may not seem that way. From the player's perspective, I would probably have to say no, that the impact, unless you are a major fan that follows everything, that reads the books, that is immersed in this, and you can look at it objectively and say, okay, yeah, this is a huge, huge element here. No, I don't think it is readily apparent to a new player or to a casual player that this is that big of a deal. So on that element, no, I don't think they quite pulled it off.
Well, I would take the opposite side. It's like, if you are a casual player, you would think this is a big deal. But if you're someone who's played Halo 3, you know that what happens here really has no consequence because in Halo 3, the Chief comes back, and that's when the real stuff kind of kicks in. So, again, not to spoil
it. I'm just thinking as far as... Yeah, well, I'm trying to avoid it on still spoiling it, but
yeah.
I see what you're saying, but it's just that at this particular point, if ODST was the only game that you ever played,
right.
You don't get that epic feeling that this is something gigantic, and I don't want
right.
to probably table this off to a later podcast.
As far as it interacts
with Halo 3, though. Yeah, the lead-in and the elements that you see that come before and after it, because, yeah, technically Halo 3 is after this, there are bigger and more important things and whatnot going on. I don't want to give it too much away on this. So
okay.
Maybe we should just table this one.
We'll table that for later. Okay, since I haven't played the game, I guess you two guys are up. Pick one element from this first part of the game and tell me whether it makes you... angry, sad, or envious. I would say there's lots of things in this game that are missing from Halo 3, so I guess you can open up Halo 3 or the other Halo games as something you could envy.
Meg, you want to start off?
Envy. Well, I guess the most obvious thing is you're not the MC. So that's something to be envious about. It would be much different if you were in there. Although this, again, goes back to the retconning. The ODST does not seem to be that much different from the MC. I mean, beyond just the fact that that there's health and that there's regenerating shields,
from a gameplay perspective or a story perspective?
Yeah, from a gameplay the perspective. I mean, even in a story, the perspective and maybe it hasn't really been shown here, although that there is a scene like early on where you meet up with a Marine and he gives you kind of like the props. Oh, it's ODST, you know, it's you're kind of a badass player. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, is that these are the best of the best.
Right. I mean, it's not, would it have been better for them to do a game, maybe not with elite soldiers of any kind, but to be an absolutely ordinary ordinary ground soldier in the war?
If we're not going to retcon the storyline, the regular grunts are just fodder for the elites.
Yeah.
They'd be toast. There'd be no fun in doing that. So, it is something that, I could, you know, like on the surface say it would be cool to be the MC, but really I guess I still am the MC in some ways. Yeah. I mean,
you're still a faceless guy who doesn't talk, who
I still get to flip
kicks
things.
Ass and takes names.
Right. I still get to pick up the turret. I still get to flip vehicles around, which you'll see later.
Now, which, the turret, we did see him running with the turret. Is this an illusion that you seem faster running with the turret than the MC is in Halo 3? Is it just because you're closer to the ground, or are you really running faster with the turret than the MC does?
I think what they did was that once you put the ODST disc into your Xbox, it looks for your Halo 3 game data, and it increases the MC's speed. So now it all makes sense. Now the MC is running.
That's the way to do a retcon.
That's exactly how you do it. You know, if you're playing the game now, it goes back in and changes all the physics of the previous games.
Well, you know, I ideally, right? I mean, this is essentially the same engine but tweaked. You'd have to think that if they weren't still tied to the DVD discs as the way you distribute this, right? You're eventually just loading all of this content and all of this executable code onto your Xbox's hard drive, because let's face it, you know, if you don't have a hard drive at this point, you know, I don't know what you're doing. I still don't know why they took the hard drive out of the 360's design anyway. But you have to wonder, why isn't there any reason why, you know, why couldn't you play the Halo 3 campaign in the ODST engine? Why wouldn't you be able to continue to upgrade the technology but keep it backwards compatible with some of the data so that you could maybe play even Halo 2 in the Halo 3 engine, you know, without some of the improvements, but with the gameplay change? I mean, look what the open source community has done with the Myth engine. I mean, you can actually, they have now a modern engine that uses modern 3D cards, and you can play through the Myth 1 and 2 campaigns in it, and you can even choose some gameplay modifications and say, okay, make it play the way Myth 1 did, or make it play it the way Myth 2 did, or even mix and match with some different modules. I mean, I'd love to see that.
I can only imagine the amount of teeth gnashing that developers would have had if part of their what they have to accomplish was keep things backwards compatible. They probably would have jumped off of their nice little building.
Oh, true. If you're talking about going back to Halo 2, but again, this is supposed to be essentially the same engine, right? At least between ODST and Halo 3.
Yeah, okay, well, that's what Blackstar, they're saying, you know, but who knows?
Yeah, Blackstar, what about you? Some item that drew your attention, and whether it made you angry, sad, or envious?
Let's see. As far as anger goes, the only one that really jumped out at me was actually in Firefight. And that really more has to do with the fact that I'm never on the same time as my friends are to play. So unfortunately, to try it out, I'm doing this solo. And in doing so, you really feel, I mean, even on easy, because I've only played some of the Firefight modes on easy mode by myself, is that, yeah, sometimes you just get absolutely beyond overwhelmed, especially in the smaller, tighter maps where you don't have a lot of room to maneuver. You are walking slower with or without a turret, and the panoply of different characters that come at you with certain weapons, especially the cloaked brutes. I actually find that the biggest problems I have are the chieftains with the hammers. Boy, those guys tick me off. And the absolute, you know, invisible. This is the first time with the particular character in Halo, they are completely invisible. The camoed brutes, I swear, I have never seen one until they start shooting and killing me. Either, you know, the game detail is so heavy, where when they are invisible, you're just distracted by everything else, or the fact that the camouflage is getting so effective is that they really are hidden. Because even with the older Halo games, even when somebody was in camo, they really weren't. You know, they were invisible, but you still saw the shimmer effect. You still saw how they reacted with things around them. This is the first time where all of a sudden a brute is literally nose to nose to me, smacking me in the head. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm shooting at someone 50 feet away. Oh, no, I'm actually looking through a person. So, yeah.
Visor doesn't help?
To a certain extent.
For me, visor and the audio clues were the way around it.
The problem is, and that's one thing we didn't get a touch on earlier on, was that visor mode doesn't work in daytime. You kick on daytime and visor mode, you are completely washed out. Everything is way too bright. I did show it in one element in the video, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it. But in Firefight, if you're doing some of the daylight sequences, you kick on visor mode only in deep shadowy areas where people might be hiding. If you're out in open daylight and you turn the thing on, boom, you're looking at a white screen. So dealing with camos guys and with that is impossible. The other thing is the chieftains. A lot of times there are dropping of 2, 3, and 4 hammer chieftains all at the same time. And if you've got one guy with no weapons, you got a plasma pistol, no grenades, and a pistol, you're in trouble. You know, you're okay. Running around with these guys hammering you like crazy.
So to fix this, do you want matchmaking in firefight? Do you want to take some of those guys who are your opponents in matchmaking and trust them to get you back in firefight?
To be honest, I wish that, yeah, there was an element where you could do that, or there were some levels that you could do that. I'm sure there are a panoply of technical reasons why either they couldn't or shouldn't or were having issues. But yeah.
I don't think it's technical. I think they just don't want people doing that. I mean, this is supposed to be entirely cooperative, and you've got enough problem with team killing in the normal matchmaking. I think this would be really annoying to be.
I love the concept
firefight with randoms.
To be honest, I love the idea of the concept of the co-op. I remember back in Halo 1 and Halo 2 days, we were talking and begging about having this. It's like, look, yeah. I don't mind playing against my friends, but I would like to play my friends against the Covenant. I would like to have a base to defend where we're all fighting bad guys, and now we've got it. The only problem is now we can only do it either by ourselves or with certain people we can get at the same time. So that's a timing issue that has nothing to do technically with the game, but unfortunately that element is
closed. You need to recycle your friends list.
To people, yeah,
that's
apparently I got to do it. I got to find more people.
The friends list isn't...
We need more than 100 people.
Yeah, but absolutely. I would definitely agree with that.
Or maybe like a dedicated ODST friends list. You know, one set aside for that, you know, if there was a way of doing that.
List.
But, yeah, firefight friends list. You know, people who you are not friendly with in other things, but that you can trust to play in this particular game.
And, yeah, because when you go on to HBO and people are posting in there saying, hey, is anybody around? I want to work on this achievement. You know,
right. If
they have to go to an online forum to beg people to jump in and play with them, I mean, obviously there's a problem there. So I'm not the only one that has issues trying to get people to play.
And what I think you were kind of saying also, though, it does lend back to we're no longer college kids or high school kids. We have other things going on. So our time to play, the window is very small. It's finding friends who are up at that time or who are available like at that time. That complicates things. So.
Maybe they could add some kind of a chat lobby feature to Waypoint, right? Mm. Where you could go in and you could just see who's ever available, and it would turn that chat room into a game and just launch the game.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up for now. Stay tuned. Our next episode will be on what is the next segment of ODST? ODST is sort of sandbox, right? So you can take some of these sequences in random order. So I guess it'll be up to you guys to determine what we actually see next.
Yeah, you do get to play and go back to it, we can pick out a couple of different elements, because if you don't, the sequence of the games, it jumps around back and forth between one particular map, which is you as the rookie, and the other characters. So if you want, we can dissect them however you'd like.
Okay, so thanks for listening, and next time, more ODST on Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampant Internet Podcast.
guys, I have to, guys, I have to very much apologize. I didn't want to ruin the mood, but, something happened like about, I don't know, maybe like 10 minutes into, like I had the GarageBand window off the screen a bit so I could concentrate on the video. And when I finally moved it up, it had stopped recording like about maybe 10 minutes into the actual film.